from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Benghazi, Monica Lewinsky, public prayer, all back in the headlines, plus Nigeria's kidnapped girls and the right now of climate change. A House Select Committee will investigate Benghazi. It is not, said John Boehner, political.
This doesn't need to be, shouldn't be, and will not be a partisan process.
A big White House report on climate change says change is upon us and taking a toll right now.
Whether it means increased flooding, greater vulnerability to drought, more severe wildfires, all these things are having an impact on Americans as we speak.
And the U.S. will help in the search for Nigeria's kidnapped schoolgirls. Here's a rally in Washington on Tuesday. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Michael Hirsch of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your top story of the week? What are your thoughts on Ukraine, Boko Haram, the Benghazi investigation, the Supreme Court's ruling on public prayer? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington, Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you right here. Also from Washington, Michael Hirsch joins us, national editor for Politico magazine. Michael Hirsch, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Michael.
Let's dive right in on Nigerian schoolgirls. This story made headlines, then disappeared for a couple of weeks. This week, it's back in a big way. Michael Hirsch, do you see a serious American intervention here? Window dressing? We're talking about sending a dozen or something like that. People, not armed soldiers to put boots on the ground, but people who can deal with victims, people who can bring in some signal intelligence, cooperate with the Nigerian government. Is this a big deal?
Well, it obviously is a big deal for the more than 270 girls who were kidnapped and their families. In terms of foreign policy, no. I mean, with all the other things going on in Ukraine and Syria and everywhere else, this is not particularly high on the agenda. But, you know, under public pressure, and I think out of some sympathy, the Obama administration is going to be sending the military intelligence and law enforcement advisors to Nigeria to help the Nigerians track down Boko Haram, the radical Islamist group that abducted the girls, and to try to, you know, rescue them. But no, we're not going to be seeing any, you know, very sizable force going in here. I mean, I think it was very, very telling, the story in recent days, that the administration had not put Boko Haram on its terrorist list, specifically because this was deemed, as President Obama himself said, a regional and local group that was not targeting the United States or U.S. interests.
But hasn't this been for some time on the list of international terror groups, Michael?
Well, it has been. But, you know, what we've seen in recent years, last year or so, particularly since the president delivered a major speech at National Defense University, is an attempt by the Obama administration to define down who the enemy is. In other words, there's only core al-Qaeda and a few al-Qaeda affiliated groups that are now considered quote-unquote strategic enemies of the United States. And as Johnny Roberts, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, just said the other day, one of the reasons Boko Haram was not put on the U.S. terrorism list was we didn't want to heighten the stature of the group, nor to inspire them to take on the United States as a target. I mean, at this point in time, the Obama administration is trying very hard to narrow down the list of U.S. enemies, not to expand them.
Nancy Cordes, I saw John Kerry saying on film, we are now going to go after Boko Haram. They're in our sights and we're going to deal with them. What does that mean? Is the United States really opening a new front in the global war on terrorism here, or is this PR for the moment when the terrible fate of this 200-300 girls is so prominent?
I think it's partly saber-rattling. I mean, the reality is that there's a big debate going on about how much we want to do. As Michael pointed out, right now, Boko Haram is not a big enemy of the United States. They're not targeting Western interests, and do we want to stir up this group and draw their attention westward when they're primarily focused on conducting what we all know are horrendous crimes in Nigeria? And how much can we do in this relatively lawless region where they operate? I think that's why you're seeing Congress not really engaging very much on this front right now, beyond showing solidarity, beyond saying the international community needs to get involved. Earlier this week, you had the group of 20 women senators sending a letter to the president saying, we need to do what we can. The international community needs to do what it can. But beyond that, Congress is sort of waiting and watching right now because they know that our options are quite limited.
Congress very engaged on the Benghazi front again this week. A special committee to be set up. John Boehner setting it up. And Democrats not sure whether they're going to join. Now, I look here, four committees already. This will be the fifth. What's different about this one, Nancy?
And that's four committees just in the House. You've also Yes. had several committees in the Senate looking into this. They've all produced huge reports on Benghazi. But a couple of weeks ago, Speaker Boehner was finally convinced by conservatives in the House that a special select Benghazi committee needed to be set up. This is something that he resisted for a long time. He said the committees of jurisdiction are handling this well. But what really riled up conservatives was when the White House was forced to release a batch of emails that it hadn't turned over before. It had to do this in response to a lawsuit. And conservatives basically said, hey, if these are emails that we wanted before and we haven't seen, what else do they have that we haven't seen? And, you know, we need to push this further. Democrats, of course, argue that this is all ground that has been covered time and time again, and that we know exactly what happened in Benghazi. We know what happened in the aftermath, and that Republicans are just trying to keep this issue alive because it really gets their base energized in a midterm election year.
John Boehner talking here on Tuesday about Benghazi and more, saying we just want the truth.
Who's gone to jail for violating the law? When is the administration going to tell the American people the truth? They've not told them the truth about Benghazi. They've not told the truth about the IRS. They've not told the truth about Fast and Furious. Now, only one would have to guess. If they're not willing to tell the American people the truth, it must not be very pretty.
And the Democrats' response, big waste of time. Here on Fox News Sunday, Democratic Congressman from California, Adam Schiff, talking about the new committee.
I think it's a colossal waste of time. We've had four bipartisan investigations of this already. And I think it's driven by a couple things. The Republican conference is so fractured. There's really only two things they agree on. They don't like Obamacare, and so we've had 50 votes on that. And they do like talking about Benghazi, so we've had four investigations on that.
Michael Hirsch, what do you see? We'll look at the IRS and Lois Lerner. What do you see going on with Benghazi here in the Select Committee?
Pure politics, you know, directly contrary to what John Boehner just said. There's no foundation to the conspiracy theorizing about Benghazi. There are serious issues. Obviously, a U.S. ambassador lost his life in the early morning hours of September 12th, 2012, and there were questions about how well protected he was, what exactly he was doing there. But these are issues of competence. These are issues of what Hillary Clinton was doing as Secretary of State in terms of whether she was ensuring maximum security in a very dangerous area. This is not a question of a cover-up and trying to pretend that there were no terrorists, which is what is swirling around the Benghazi issue. This is purely an attempt to taint both Obama and Hillary Clinton ahead of a prospective 2016 run for the presidency by her, and there's no foundation whatsoever to the conspiracy accusation.
I mean, the conspiracy accusation, as you put it, is really, though, about an allegation of cover-up or misrepresentation, isn't it? And don't these emails indicate that may have merit?
No, what happened was in the days right after the attack in 2012, there was confusion over who exactly was responsible, what inspired it. There were protests in Cairo, Egypt, and other cities at that time against a U.S.-made video that appeared to slander the Prophet Muhammad. And there were some questions raised by the intelligence community that terrorists in Benghazi were inspired by that video and the demonstrations going on to attack the U.S. Consulate and installations there. Now, they were not clear on what happened. So Susan Rice, then the U.S. ambassador, U.N. ambassador, was sent out on TV talk shows on Sunday to discuss all this, and she raised the possibility that it might have been inspired by this video and said that, you know, extremists had attacked. Now, this whole issue of a conspiracy rests on the idea that somehow the administration knew it was terrorists, was trying to cover up that fact because it wanted to play down the rise of terrorism in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, wanted to play up the fact that President Obama had actually done very well against al-Qaeda, because remember, this was the heat, the heart of the presidential election going on then. But there's simply no evidence that that is what happened, that the administration knew and had some hard evidence that the culprits were anyone but whom but the people that Susan Rice said on the TV talk show. She was simply reflecting what was known at the time. And of course, as time went on, the intelligence community adjusted its assessment of what had happened in Benghazi. But the whole idea that there was some sort of a conscious cover-up of the truth has just never stood up against the actual evidence.
Jack Beatty, the merits of an investigation here and the implications of this for Hillary Clinton, for a run for president, if she should, for her contemplation of making that run, if she's still contemplating.
That's a big part of this. Charles Krauthammer today insinuates that instead of managing the crisis in the Situation Room, the president from the White House was talking to Secretary Clinton in a sinister phone conversation over some time, concocting a cover story, setting up the, you know, infamous anti-Mohammed video is the reason for the attack, not a lapse in U.S. security. Clinton will have to answer such questions when the Select Committee subpoenas her. Embarrassing her does seem to be one of the GOP motives. Question is, will they embarrass themselves?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour, indignation and the U.S. role on Nigeria's kidnapped girls, a House Special Select Committee on Benghazi, a ruling on public prayer, VA scandal, climate change hitting home, and more. Michael Hirsch joins us from Politico magazine out of Washington today. Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News, is here. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Lots of callers, no small number on Nigeria. Samuel in Boston. Samuel, you're on the air.
Yes, please. Thank you, Tom, for the help you have been doing over this issue. The problem we have in Nigeria, I'm in Nigeria.
Okay.
I know the problem that is going on in Nigeria is the people in the northern part of the country, whenever they have a meeting with the president, they will leak the part of the people in the executive will leak the information to the Boko Haram. This is why the president was very mad, because they know that the president is from the south. That is the issue. This is why the president never take the responsibility at the beginning. I'm very happy now that the United States, the breaches, and those people will be caught within a couple of days. I know that. If they can keep the secret from the part of the military in Nigeria.
There are reports here that there was information moving between the government and the rebels that in part led them not to get involved here. What we ultimately accomplished with this modest U.S. intervention, we'll have to see, Samuel. I mean, we had that very provocative tape this week. This was video on Monday obtained by the Agence France-Presse, this Boko Haram leader, Abubakar Shekau, claiming responsibility for that kidnapping and saying he will sell these girls.
I kidnapped your daughters. I will sell them at the market in the name of Allah. There's a market to sell humans. Allah said I should sell them. He ordered me to sell them. I will sell these women. I sell women.
I will sell these women. I mean, talk about shaking your fist in the face of the world and the world responding this week, but how widely dispersed these girls are. Namita in New Orleans. Namita, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you.
What do you think?
I think the U.S. should support. I think we should do something about the Nigerian girls. I think it's really important that the U.S. shows support for women and women's rights, and this is a way that we can really use our army to go forth.
Of course, the army is not in there yet, and if we got involved with Boko Haram, I don't know what would come of that. It's a small footprint so far. We'll see what follows. One more right here. David in Lexington, South Carolina. David, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I don't believe that we need any further investigation of Benghazi. I think that this is specifically designed as a smear campaign for Clinton. There's several facts that are out there. The first one is that the ambassador did not want extra security. He was relying on the local militias, and the local militias are what turned on him, and that's how this whole thing went down. And to try and make this into some sort of hiding of stuff by the Obama administration, it was a fluid situation. They didn't even know what was going on. So how in the world can they say al-Qaeda was in there? Al-Qaeda was never even in Libya. None of the militias wanted al-Qaeda in there. So it was not that bad of... It was not a terrorist attack led by al-Qaeda, which is what they're trying to pin on Clinton, and it's not going to stick.
Well, it was certainly an attack. The administration was happy to ultimately call people terrorists, and certainly four ended up dead. Nancy Cordes, what course do you expect the Select Committee's investigation to take, and over what period of time?
Well, you know, Democrats have really been debating whether they're going to take part in this panel. You've got a panel that's set up to have seven Republicans and five Democrats. And some Democrats have argued if we get involved, then we're just look like we're condoning this committee. On the other hand, and I think that this is the argument that's eventually going to win out, many Democrats say if we aren't involved, we have no influence on how long this thing goes on, who gets called to testify, and what they get asked when they do testify. They're worried about the spectacle of seven Republicans sitting there in a row grilling Hillary Clinton or Susan Rice or whoever it is, with no Democrats to sort of refute what the Republicans are saying. So I do anticipate that you will have Democrats and Republicans on this committee, and that it will go on doing its work for months. It has until the end of this congressional session in January, which is when it would run out no matter what, unless they reinstate it. And I think you'll see a series of high-profile subpoenas. You'll see depositions taking place behind closed doors. Even though Republicans say this is not going to be a circus, this is going to be very respectful, and they're looking to get to the truth, one thing that's complicating that argument is that the National Republican Congressional Committee is advertising on its website that you, too, can become a Benghazi watchdog if you donate a suggested minimum of $25. And that's something that became quite controversial this week. But the Republicans didn't back down. They've still got that donation request up on their website, and that's leading to Democratic charges that this is all for political reasons.
Nancy, another political live wire on Capitol Hill this week, Lois Lerner from the IRS, she who took the fifth a year ago, and in the hot seat this week with contempt charges against her. What exactly does that mean? They're going to throw her in a brig somewhere, or is there some follow-up with this? What?
No, it gets referred to the local attorney general here in D.C., and it will continue. He has the option to cite her if he wants. Of course, he's appointed by the president, so it's unlikely that will go any further. This is yet another issue that Republicans believe hasn't been investigated fully. The fact that some Tea Party groups were targeted for extra scrutiny a couple of years ago. Democrats, again, argue we have looked into this thoroughly. We know how it happened. We know why it happened, and it's been fixed. Lois Lerner is sort of right up there with Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton as one of the main targets for Republicans right now.
Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding here politically in all these stories? Is this, standard operating procedure for the pregame as a presidential campaign season joins us? Is this above and beyond?
Well, it's certainly that, but also for 2014, it may just be a coincidence. But this week, and Nancy can tell us more about this, in a hearing at the House, insurance executives from, Blue Cross, Cigna, and other groups were asked about the Affordable Care Act. And, one of the things they were asked, is this a government takeover of American health care? No, they said it really isn't. In fact, their profits are up. Well, what about you're not getting people paying? Well, as a matter of fact, we are getting them. 80% 5% are paying. And they went on in that vein saying that some good things about the act, how it's working. They also had a lot of complaints. But the Republicans were abashed, including our friend Michael Burgess from Texas, who said, you know, you people just aren't forthcoming. Well, the Republicans wanted them to say that the Affordable Care Act was a disaster, that no one was signing, and that's not what they were saying. So the Republicans very badly need an alternative. I mean, I'm not saying that the whole narrative on Obamacare is going to change, but there are facts out there that contradict the official GOP line from corporations. And so now they need something else, and they've got it with these scandals.
Michael, how about it? The Obamacare critique not standing up on the basis of insurance company reporting back. Do you see Republicans pivoting here? They're going to stick with the whole smorgasbord.
Yeah, I think they want to make it as big a smorgasbord of political issues as possible. And, you know, as was said earlier, I think there are two big issues right now for really mobilizing and exciting their base, you know, are Obamacare and Benghazi. And so I think that the political value of those issues is going to withstand any application of fact. And so you get this sort of a state of denial, you know, as we just heard in this hearing, when despite evidence that, in fact, Obamacare is taking hold, that it is becoming increasingly popular, that it's working, that those states that have refused, for example, Medicare funds are suffering a higher death rate, as we just reported the other day. Despite all these facts, the Republicans, you know, have had like 50 votes against Obamacare and are going to continue in that vein at least through 2014, because this is an issue that gets GOP conservative voters out for them. And that is really the main thing on their minds.
Let's go to Emily.
Tom,
Nancy,
I will say that one quick thing is the Democrats, it's not all rosy for them on this front. I mean, they are very worried about what the premiums are going to look like when the insurance companies unveil them for the following year this fall. If the people who have signed up for Obamacare are sicker or older than was expected, those premiums are going to be higher than expected, and that's going to be a big blow going into the midterm elections.
Of course, we've got a new Health and Human Services nominee up, and she talked to senators, Republicans, saying, look, we plan to take a majority in the Senate, and we're going to come after your Obamacare. How deep could changes be if there's a Republican Congress, both houses, Nancy?
You know, they can try to whack away at the law, and you can bet that that's going to be priority number one if Republicans control the House and the Senate. Now, obviously, the president has the ability to veto major legislation if he wants to, unless they are somehow able to get two-thirds of the Senate. That would be incredibly difficult to do. But you know, they'll try to pass laws that starve the bill of funding. They'll try to slip measures that weaken the law into other bills that the president wants to have passed. So this will be an all-out fight for sure.
Emily in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Emily, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Very well. What do you think?
I think we're all missing the boat. I think the issue, the biggest issue that we're facing right now is Ukraine. And the weak and anemic response that President Obama has had to that situation. This is, we're talking Europe. We're talking a potentially highly destabilizing situation in Europe. Ukraine, I don't think, is very far from sliding into a Syria-type situation. Imagine that kind of situation in Europe with Putin behind the scenes as the puppeteer. And I think the weak response to the situation in Crimea has then led to Putin's bravado now in eastern Ukraine. And I think it's also connected to what's happening in the South China Sea. You know, China's looking at this and saying, well, Obama's not willing to use force. He's not willing, you know, to brandish the big stick. So we're going to see if we can't grab some land ourselves. Putin did it. Why can't we?
Emily, we've got it. And the next thing you know, you've got Chinese ships and Vietnamese ships banging into each other and water cannon unleashed in the South China Sea. Putin on, just yesterday, saying there were no longer Russian troops at the Ukrainian border. Here he is interpreted by RT, Russian television.
We've constantly been told that our troops near the Ukrainian borders are stirring concerns. We've pulled them back. Today, they're not located near the Ukrainian border, but at the locations of their regular exercises.
Of course, big exercises occurred right after that, including nuclear test exercises and a huge display of Russian military might in Moscow and beyond. Putin himself in Crimea, which was, of course, part of Ukraine until like day before yesterday or, you know, a couple months ago now. John Kerry talking this week about the push for a referendum, maybe to separate eastern Ukraine from the rest, saying it was bogus. But that is still on for Sunday. Here's Kerry.
We also are very concerned about efforts of pro-Russian separatists in Donetsk and Luhansk to organize, frankly, a contrived, a bogus independence referendum on May 11th. We flatly reject this illegal effort to further divide Ukraine.
Our caller says, look at the big picture here, Ukraine. Others are saying online and elsewhere, climate change, watch out for the minutiae. It's all out there this week, and we're looking at it. Michael Hirsch, what do you see unfolding at this point in Ukraine? Does it look like Putin is on track to take eastern Ukraine more? And what about our caller's assertion that once you let go of international order that says borders don't change like this, hey, that can go anywhere. That can go straight to the South China Sea and beyond.
Well, yeah, the latter point, I think, is correct. It's one that the U.S. presidents have been trying to assert in the modern period since George H.W. Bush stood down Saddam Hussein after the latter's invasion of Kuwait. Obviously, Obama's response and the Europeans' response to what Putin did in Ukraine, specifically the annexation of Crimea, was different. It was not going to be military force used between two major nuclear armed powers like the U.S. and Russia, but sanctions instead. And there has been a lot of criticism of whether Obama could have done more. Now, the latest wrinkle in this very complex situation is that Putin himself, perhaps in response to Western pressure, including sanctions, just said the other day that perhaps this referendum on separating off eastern Ukraine should not be held. But he was rebuffed by the leaders, of the self-styled Donetsk People's Republic.
Do you believe that was a genuine rebuff? I mean, it's he can say whatever he likes and wink, wink, nod, nod, you go, guys.
Well, that's a very legitimate question. He's a savvy guy, former KGB, that is Vladimir Putin, and it may just be part of his broad covert effort to bring eastern Ukraine into his orbit, while at the same time maintaining some, international respectability. That's very possible. But what we do have now is these separatist leaders who desperately need this vote to maintain any kind of legitimacy at all in what they're doing, which is to occupy buildings in eastern Ukraine and stand off the Ukrainian army. They appear to need to have this referendum. So, we'll see what happens, but it's all very dicey. It's not entirely clear what Putin's designs are. It may not be a full-scale invasion. It may in fact be this sort of covert, stealthy, bit-by-bit effort to pull eastern Ukraine into Moscow's orbit without sort of putting up Russian troops that would truly take this to a whole new level in terms of the response that would be needed.
Jack Beatty, who needs an invasion? He's already got Crimea without it. Eastern Ukraine is in turmoil, more than eastern, even over in Odessa. I know you're a guy who very carefully weighs U.S. interests whenever we talk about stomping around, Jack. But what about global order and borders and knock-on effects? What do you see here?
Well, I think Emily certainly has a point, and I think President Obama lends himself to that narrative when, as he said in Los Angeles the other day, he was talking about the use of American power, as some in Washington have insisted calling for use in Syria and Nigeria and so on. And he said, well, that's not our only option. He said, instead, by keeping memories alive, by telling stories, by hearing those stories, we can do our part. He was speaking before the Shoah Foundation at the University of Southern California, so was talking about memory as a way of, remembering genocide, but not preventing it. And I think that kind of talk, which seems to be saying, well, we're a powerful country, but we can't do anything. We can keep stories alive. We can talk. I think that lends itself to the view of the president is weak. My own view is there are no vital U.S. interests in Ukraine about which we should fight. Nevertheless, I think the president gives that ammunition.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the horse with a humble pedigree, California Chrome, When the Kentucky Derby owner Steve Coburn was over the moon for his horse and 77-year-old trainer Art Sherman.
All I got to say is, do you non-believers believe this horse now and believe this man can train a horse? Because if you don't, you need to have your head examined.
Eight hung-by-their-hair circus performers injured at a Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey show when everything crashed down. Here's witness Shelley Berry.
I screamed. I'm like, that's not right. You know, sometimes you're surprised and it's part of the show, but this clearly wasn't.
And another White House correspondence dinner. President Obama made fun of himself and a not-so-good year.
I usually start these dinners with a few self-deprecating jokes. After my stellar 2013, what could I possibly talk about?
Host Joel McHale, star of NBC's Community, rubbed it all in.
The website is now the thing people use to describe other bad things. They say stuff like, ugh, I shouldn't have eaten that sushi. I was up all night, healthcare.gov.
You can join the conversation this hour. We're looking at a week in the news. Climate change is happening, they say. Will we do something about it? Will we do enough? What do you think of the VA scandal? Will Shelley Sterling keep the Clippers? Is China taking a cue from Moscow now, getting pushy in the South China Sea? And then there's the Supreme Court and prayer in public meetings. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Michael Hirsch is here, national editor at Politico magazine. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to our listeners, Alan in Boston. Alan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks. I'm calling about the White House climate change report.
Yes.
The report was timely, following on the heels of the extreme weather events of the previous week and those things we saw last winter. What concerns me is the lack of action by Congress and the minor solutions proposed by the White House, such as more energy-efficient federal buildings. What we really need is a major structural change in the economy, such as a carbon fee, to really stimulate activity to achieve more efficiency and reduce emissions. Mm-hmm. Instead, what we've got is Congress sneezing Benghazi.
So a mismatch here, or effort in the wrong place, you're saying, Alan?
A failure to really do anything. You know, Rome is burning. This problem is growing on us, and it's going to grow even faster, and we're going to look back on these days and say, what were we thinking?
Yeah.
We were paying attention to minor issues when we should have been making the major changes we need to adapt to climate change.
Alan, let us sit with this one for a minute. The headlines were very big, the White House pushing very hard on this, and then in the American Way also pushed back, saying, well, this is a White House political agenda. But when you look at those charts, when you look at the evidence, it's already taking a toll, the White House says. Here was the White House science advisor. This was John Holdren. In a conference call with reporters on Tuesday, saying the latest national climate assessment makes it clear the country's already experiencing the effects of climate change.
Summers on the whole have been getting longer and hotter with longer periods of extreme heat. Wildfires in the West have been starting earlier in the spring and continuing later into the fall. In a lot of places, rain is coming down in heavier downpours.
Here's California Congressman Henry Waxman jumping on it on Wednesday, talking with C-SPAN's Washington Journal.
We either take the science seriously and go down the path of reducing these carbon emissions from power plants and other sources and try to transition so our economy doesn't get jolted to a low-carbon economy, and at the same time make our industry the leader in the world in development of new technologies, or we do what seems to be happening with the Republicans in charge of the House, deny the science.
Our listeners are all over this. Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. Yes, all those other topics are so important. I definitely think that those have to be dealt with, but the environment is the most because it affects everybody. And I'm here in Des Moines. As you know, there's a lot of farming here in Iowa.
Sure.
We're dealing with major farm runoff, and that combined with environmental issues that are happening because of carbon dioxide is really starting to affect things here. But there's a lot of heads in the sand, and I think this is an issue that is going to be there for the Democrats come the next cycle.
We'll see. Let us pick it up, all three. Michael Hirsch, I'll come to you first.
Yep.
You can't make a bigger trumpet blast, really, than the White House tried to do this week on this, putting out what it described as the evidence and the maps showing all the different consequences, and we understand if those are related to climate change, that's a big price tag for climate change already, and it's early days in terms of that change. Does this at some point go into major policy change? You hear our listeners saying there, bring on a carbon tax, change the economic structure that encourages the burning of all this fossil fuel. Let's go. Is there traction on the horizon?
I don't see it, frankly. I think the Obama administration is using this report to tout rules that it can put into place on its own. For example, most specifically, the Environmental Protection Agency wants to reduce coal power pollution and was sort of given the open door to do that by the Supreme Court on April 29th when it reaffirmed the EPA's ability to do this. But these are changes on the margins, something that could, you know, profoundly change the way the nation uses and burns energy would require Congress to act, and you're simply not going to get that in the Republican-controlled House, where, again, you know, as we've already heard, Republicans tend to dismiss reports like this and the science and the consensus around the science as a purely politicized effort to tamp down the U.S. economy, to make up climate stories where there are none. It does not seem that they're interested in whatever evidence is being put forward in this report or any other.
Nancy Cordes, is there a point at which the charts and graphs and actual temperatures and reports of all the evidence of severe weather and the works turns into an irresistible force when it comes to legislation, outlook, denial?
I actually think there was more of a push by Democrats for environmental legislation a few years ago than there is now, because I think that they felt that, A, they were beating their heads against the wall, and B, that particularly Democrats in swing states were taking a beating for it and they weren't getting the legislation through anyway. So why put themselves out there? The Republican position has not changed. Many Republicans, as Michael pointed out, don't believe the science. Others feel that the science may be right, but that government shouldn't get overly involved and that it's only going to hurt business. And so, you know, you do see this week the Senate debating an energy bill that would make some changes. It would require the federal government to install some new technologies. It would impose some tougher building codes that would be more environmentally friendly. But it's getting tied up over the issue of the Keystone Pipeline and whether that is going to be a part of the bill or not. And if it isn't, Republicans may end up just scuttling that bill. So you don't see any big debate anymore over something like a carbon tax, as Alan was talking about, some of these major structural changes that would have a huge, meaningful impact on the environment just aren't being discussed right now.
Jack Beatty, the scientists say the clock is ticking. And here it is laid out in big maps across page one of lots of newspapers and computer screens across this country this week. When, if ever, does that turn into decisive policy, political action, Jack? Or do, I don't know, 1,000 years from now, they look back on, you know, the United States like we look back on Rome drinking lead and saying, what were they doing?
You know, it's tragic that there's a party difference on this now, difference on the science even. This wasn't true just to, you know, I remember polls around the time of the 2004 election of delegates to the Republican National Convention. There was strong environmental support there. Delegates to the convention were saying they would sacrifice economic growth for the environment. And yet that whole picture, which was a large part of Republican politics, that has just gone and it's all been politicized. You know, I think desperately we need to make this in a populist issue, and there's a way to do it. Susan Collins, a few years ago, introduced a bill that went nowhere because it looked as if they were going to do cap and trade instead. That faltered. The bill was essentially called cap and dividend, and it would be a way of raising the real, you know, essentially polluters would have to pay the real cost of energy, and that money, you know, essentially your electric bill would go up. up, and if you didn't earn, if you didn't use more electricity than some norm, you would get a dividend. And it could be as much as $2,500 a person if you were thrifty with your use of electricity. In other words, this could be like a sort of Alaska fund, not connected, which is connected there to taking oil out of the ground, but this would be a fund for giving people an incentive not to use as much energy and getting paid for it. And I'm surprised that hasn't caught on, because that is the American way.
Cash on the barrelhead. Of course, where all this goes will depend in some part on who's controlling Congress. Republican primaries this week. On Tuesday, GOP establishment candidate Tom Tillis won the primary for Senate in North Carolina, beating more conservative candidates. He'll go up against Democratic incumbent Kay Hagan in November. Here's a little bit of Tillis' victory speech.
It's not the end of the primary. It's really the beginning of our primary mission, which has been the mission all along. And that is to beat Kay Hagan and to make Harry Reid irrelevant in American.
Michael Hirsch, what do you read in these primaries? This one in particular, is the Tea Party back on its heels? Are mainstream Republicans back in the saddle? What does it all portend for the midterms come this fall?
Well, North Carolina in this particular race has been called a bellwether. North Carolina, very interesting demographics that are changing, you know, a red state that's become more purplish. And so there are questions about whether, if in fact this new nominee beats Kay Hagan and shifts the balance in the Senate, whether that, you know, will be a broader part of a broader trend. It does seem at the moment, you know, with Tom Tillis beating the Tea Party candidate, as if the Tea Party is back on its heels, not nearly as many primary challenges with the prospect of success as the last time around in 2012 and 2010. So what you have is the party establishment kind of reasserting itself, saying to the base, look, we actually have a chance to take back both, you know, take the House back, of course, maintain our control and take back the Senate, but we have to be united. And so, you know, it will be a very, very interesting thing to watch to see whether Tillis can come out of nowhere and basically beat Kay Hagan.
Nancy, if the Tea Party is back on its heels, does that make the GOP more or less likely to take the Senate?
It helps them a lot in the Senate because in states, purple states like North Carolina, if you have a Tea Party candidate who wins in the primary, then it's much more difficult for them to beat the Democrat in the general like Kay Hagan than if you've got someone who's more of a mainstream candidate like Tom Tillis. And I think that you're definitely seeing the GOP establishment turning the page and trying out a new playbook. I mean, they threw millions of dollars into this primary to pump up their pick, Tom Tillis, and to weaken the Tea Party challenger. You see that they are not as afraid of these challengers as they used to be. They are going after them more aggressively, and you're really seeing Tea Party candidates fade in several other states where they were coming on strong in the beginning, in Kentucky, in Mississippi. And that doesn't mean that they're fading in House races. I think that that's a totally different story. And I think there, Republicans are much less worried about Tea Party candidates. In fact, I think that they feel that a lot of energy is behind those Tea Party candidates and that they really invigorate primary voters. But when it comes to Senate races, where these candidates are going to have to run statewide, the GOP is not letting that process play out by itself anymore. They are getting heavily involved.
We'll look at prayer and the VA. VA first and quickly. Nancy, just let me ask you, do you think the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Eric Shinseki, can hang in? There's reports out of the Phoenix VA this week saying that they've had a shadow waiting list there, 40 dead waiting for treatment of American military veterans. Does Shinseki hang in?
I think it depends on whether members of Congress call for him to resign. I mean, you've had some prominent groups now do that. But if Congress, for the most part, stands by him or says, well, you know, we want to see how he handles this, then, you know, he's got the backing of the president. He says that he wants to stay in there. He's had a very good reputation up until this point. He very much can survive, but it depends on how he handles this. It depends on what kind of information comes out about these VA centers and these lists. And it depends, I think, on how heavily certain senators pursue this. I mean, this was really brought to light in large part because Senators McCain and Flake of of Arizona sort of really beat the drum about it. And if it turns out that he knew about these lists or that he knew about the problem and didn't do anything, it is going to be a challenge for him. On the other hand, he has been arguing very vociferously for years that the VA does not have the resources that it needs to deal with this burgeoning veterans population. And he has made no bones about the fact that he is incredibly stretched caring for these people who have served our country because the VA doesn't have the resources that it needs.
And then we've got a big Supreme Court ruling on Monday saying the Constitution allows town boards, town meetings to start their sessions with prayers, sectarian prayers, 5-4 vote. One of the defendants, the town of Greece, New York, Supervisor Bill Reilish, spoke to a local NBC affiliate.
My worry was for America and our right to be able to freely speak. And I thought that was something that was in danger. And I'm glad that this decision came down the way it did.
But here's one of the plaintiffs, Linda Stevens, telling CBS News why she disagreed with the Supreme Court's majority ruling.
We do not need prayers in government meetings. You shouldn't be, required to stand up, bow your head, and pray to Jesus.
Jack Beatty, here we are again with a 5-4 decision. You remember the days when the court would get it together and all rally around one view, a deeply divided court. What do you make of this, Jack, that Jesus is going to be there in a whole lot of town meetings around this country? Jack? Well, it sounds like we may have lost Jack's connection there a bit. Michael Hirsch, what do you make of this ruling?
Well, this is a very, very old fight, obviously, and the 5-4 decision reflects just how divided the country continues to be about public prayer, prayer in public places in a country that, the Constitution declares should have a separation of church and state. And I think there wasn't very much that was surprising about this in terms of who voted which way.
In the arguments, Nancy, I mean, here's Calvin, one of our listeners, says, I can't imagine a better example of church and state not being separate than sectarian prayers at the city hall. Any movement in the arguments here, Nancy, or just the old lines?
I think, you're seeing the old divide, as Michael said, and this is I don't think we've heard the last of this argument. It's an argument that's playing out in state courts as well.
Watch this space, and if you're at a town meeting, you may hear a quite vigorous prayer go up. Could be from any angle, depending on who's making that prayer. Hey, it turns out the Supreme Court says, for now, that is America. Nancy Cordes with CBS News. It's been great to have you with us this hour. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Oh, so great, as always. Thanks, Tom.
And Michael Hirsch, now at Politico. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, too. This is On Point.